Good morning. And good morning. Let's see. Let's try to turn the light up a little bit, somebody. And I would like to pass these out so somebody can pass these out. Or just pass them around. And there should be some for the Founders Hall, too. Hopefully. Save a couple for those guys back there, okay? Actually, you may have to do every other person because probably didn't make enough. So this morning, I'm going to talk about Manjushri Bodhisattva and Maitreya Bodhisattva. And those of you who've been around here for a while have heard me talk about Manjushri probably a lot. Maitreya, not so much. And in back of me is Manjushri. In back of me is Manjushri. So some of you can see Manjushri, some of you can't. But Manjushri, these are two bodhisattvas, right? And for us in Zen, these bodhisattvas are archetypes for us to emanate, for us to discover and emanate. We can say they're out there. You can do that. You can say they're in here. Doesn't matter what you say. They're archetypes to give us some encouragement in our practice, in our life. So Manjushri, that Manjushri is sitting on a lion. Manjushri is generally sitting on a lion, or not, although not always. And Manjushri has a sword made of diamonds. And he's sitting on this lion because when he does his zazen, he finds all kinds of scary things coming up. He has to be courageous. He has to be courageous because things are coming up all the time. Just when you think you're getting calm, something else is coming up. And you have to be courageous to stay with that, even if it's something yucky. And the stuff that comes up is not always that pleasant. Although sometimes it's quite pleasant. But that stuff also, if you stick with it, it gets yucky pretty soon. So Manjushri teaches us to sit on that lion, and to use our sword of wisdom, the diamond sword that cuts through everything, that severs all of our fixations, all of our concerns, all of our worry, yesterday, today, tomorrow, last year, when I was 14, on and on and on and on. Again, so Manjushri is severs that stuff with his diamond sword. This Manjushri doesn't have a diamond sword. He's just hanging out on top of the lion. He must have already cut away all that stuff. good luck. Good luck. So as you know, this is what Zazen, this is what Zen meditation is about. Stripping away this edifice that we've created. We created a house, and we carry that house around us all the time. Front, back, sides, bathroom, kitchen. And instead of being here in this world, we're living within the house. And we're looking out the window at the world. Oh, there is a window. But we do that to protect ourselves. We do that because we've been acculturated to do that. We do that because it feels safe. But that house ain't going to stay anyway. So it's not really as safe as it seems. So we deconstruct that. That's the process of Zen meditation. Deconstruction. So here in the morning, every morning, we chant the same sutra over and over again. The same one is chanted in Zen temples in China and Japan, all over the world. And what is it? The Heart Sutra. And what does it do? It negates everything. It negates all of our beliefs. Only the problem is, the one that we chant negates all the beliefs that Buddhists had at the beginning of the first century. So that's what we're negating. We have not yet developed the American Heart Sutra. Maybe in another 10, 20, 30, 100 years, we'll develop the American Heart Sutra, where we negate all of our attachments as Americans, all of our specific greeds and insecurities as Americans, as immigrants who need it all, who want it all. But we can develop ours. We've got plenty of time. Meanwhile, we just chant this old one without even knowing what we're negating because we haven't learned it in the first place, although some of you now are learning it because we're studying early Buddhism here. And with his sword, he cuts all four sides of the house. He severs them all. He, as we sever them all with our determined sitting. Determined, but not macho. Just steady. And the four sides of the house in traditional Buddhism are referred to as by Nagarjuna as the four sides of the fortress that need to be negated, that need to be deconstructed. And you guys have heard me talk about this before. So the first one is, let's say that we decide we're going to commit ourselves to meditation because we'll feel better in the long run if we sit regularly. Maybe I'll say that to someone. You'll feel better in the long run. I don't say how long. I'm fairly shrewd about this. I'm getting shrewder all the time. So, you'll feel better. I'll feel better in the long run if I maintain a sitting routine. But then, what does Nagarjuna come along? He, the first negation, the front of the house is, there's no eye to feel better in the first place. Forget it. That eye is just a fabrication. It's just all those cultural beliefs that have been inculcated in us that we rehearse over and over again, obsessively trying to get it right, obsessively trying to be good boys and girls, to get our needs met, to get our desires taken care of. So that first negation, the front of the house, goes. And we go to the sides of the house. The second side is, oh, well, if there's no I, then there's no I. Wow, I can just do anything. There's nothing in particular, just be in the now. Tim's always talking about being in the now. Wow, just be in the now. But that is negated too, because if you do that, you end up with social chaos. My grandson is visiting with me right now, with his mother, and his father's going to come soon. And just this last 3 days, or maybe 4 days, he started whining when he wants stuff. And his mother says to him, Ethan, say please and tell us what you want. And then he said, please, Mama, please, Grandpa. We say, good, Ethan. Then he goes back to, meow, meow, meow. This is the acculturation process that human beings need to go through. We need that process, or we'll all be whining at each other forever. So no, not I. No, not I. That's the second one we take down, a second wall we take down. And the third wall that we take down is the wall of neither both I and not I. Because then we think we've got it figured out. Oh, from Tim's talk, I realize there's both I and not I. Now we've got a great new formula for our life. But that formula is just based on language. Language, English language in particular, has opposites. It's based on opposites. And as soon as we get attached to those, the way that we've got it worked out, we don't really have it worked out. It's just a trick that we play on ourselves. When I was talking about this one last time, somebody said, well, really this sounds like the Hegelian synthesis from Hegel. But it's not. Hegel said thesis, antithesis, synthesis. But as soon as we're trying to bring something together, we're trying to make it right by this formula of bringing things together. It's another fabrication. So we take down that wall. Then all we've got is the back wall to cling to. And Nagarjuna says, and this one is always hard for us, for me to say, neither is there no I nor no lack of I. And then we've deconstructed the house. And that's our meditation, is deconstructing it. And when we deconstruct that, at the same time, we deconstruct the greed, the arrogance, the hatred, the stupidity that make up this fortress that we've created for ourselves. We deconstruct that because it's the house that keeps those things alive. So Zen Buddhism is really, I've always considered it that way, to be deconstruction Buddhism. There's lots of Buddhism, but Zen Buddhism is deconstruction Buddhism. If you meet the Buddha, kill him, murder him, annihilate him. This sounds kind of violent, doesn't it? But don't worry. Annihilate him and resume your function as the, as Rinzai said, the great woman or man of no title. That's your function, your primary function in this world. No title. Teacher, student, father, grandson, no title. Beyond that. Which is not very far at all. Not far at all. Just deconstruction. So, many of you have heard me give this talk before about Manjushri. But I also want to talk today about Maitreya. Maitreya isn't here in the Zendo. Maitreya, though, is a very important bodhisattva in Buddhism. Actually, he was the first bodhisattva, and you find him both in Theravada and Pali and in Mahayana Sanskrit. So he's the first one, and he's probably the most dependent on bodhisattva in Buddhism as a whole. And Maitreya, Maitri means love or loving kindness. Metta in Pali, love or loving kindness. So Maitreya Buddha. So Manjushri up there, the guy up there, deconstructs time so that we can see all time is included in the present. But a component of that is historical time and linear time. And we are linear beings. We have a past. We grow up, we age, we leave this earth. It's linear. And this is the bodhisattva who reminds us that it takes love, hope, to do this, to live in this life. It takes love and hope to live in this life. So Maitreya Bodhisattva and other forms of Buddhism, lots of Buddhists pray to Maitreya. And when I read that first, I thought, oh, that couldn't be real Buddhism. But I hate to say that they think it's the real Buddhism and ours is not real. So, come Maitreya, come. Come Maitreya, come. But for us, it's the archetype of love and hope about a future. About a future. So you see the picture of Maitreya there. That's just Maitreya's face. Maitreya could be, that picture of Maitreya could be compared to Rodin's The Thinker. It could be, for fun, I'm comparing it to Rodin's The Thinker, right? If you know about Rodin's The Thinker, Rodin's The Thinker also has his hand up to his face. But what's the difference that you get from Rodin's The Thinker? What's Rodin's The Thinker doing? He's crunched over, his brow is furrowed, he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. I won't say what country he's from. You know, he's French. The weight of the world on his shoulders. Worried, trying to get it right. Trying to figure it out, done beautifully. tension in all his muscles, cramped. And Maitreya, sitting upright, relaxed, touching his chin, enjoying the feel of his chin as he touches it. Just enjoying the feel of it. Delicate, graceful, but not some kind of cultured graceful, just the grace that comes out of being. And sometimes you will find Maitreya also bent over weeping for people's suffering, the suffering that people create. So I would say that Maitreya Bodhisattva, while we don't talk about him much, is just as important as Manjushri Bodhisattva in our practice, in our Zen practice, in our sitting. Because our sitting takes commitment. It takes hope. And it takes some loving kindness. Because we so easily get discouraged by it. We see that our mind is not cooperating in this process. We made the commitment to 20 minutes a day, but our mind is just off, off, off. Comes back for a little, off, off, off. Oh, ticks, and then we think. We start swearing, you know, we start thinking about how we're wasting time, you know, how maybe we should try a different meditation with it. We do all that stuff as human beings, right? So we need loving kindness. We need to be kind to ourselves. And as you know, in Zen, in at least my style of Zen, we not only deconstruct, but I encourage people to do loving kindness meditations, specific metta meditations. It's one of the pillars that I've been talking about, where you start with loving kindness toward yourself, and then you extend out to your immediate family, then from there to people beyond your family, then from there to strangers and supposed enemies, then to the plants and the animals and the birds and the waters and the sky and the earth. if that doesn't sell your mind down just for a couple minutes, I don't know what you should do. Well, there are lots of other things to do. Don't worry about it. Don't give up on this practice. Don't give up on it. Ultimately, it's transformative. It's transformative. So anyone who's going to stick with Zen meditation needs Maitreya as support. Needs Maitreya as support. And secondly, Maitreya what? Well, once Manjushri has cleared away all that debris that's hanging around all the time, all those weeds, all that overgrown brush that you pay so much attention to. Jeez, you pay so much attention to it. After you have let go of that, after you have let those weeds just dry up and blow away through your mindful meditation, through your just being here with this attentiveness to whatever, then there's a chance for planting a little seed in that rich earth, a little seed that's not going to be overwhelmed by those weeds. It's not going to be overwhelmed by that ivy, even though the ivy is beautiful. And that little seed is hope in your heart. It's hope in your heart. It's love. And it just comes up on its own. It just comes up on its own. But it needs Maitreya's help, because so easily we get discouraged. So easily we get discouraged. So in your programs, I notice some of you have programs, I put a haiku from Basho. Basho, 17th century Zen practitioner and haiku poet. And in that poem, which is very simple, the beginning of culture, rice planting songs in the innermost part of the country. In that poem, he's being literal and he's also using metaphor. And the literalness is that in the 17th century in Japan, ancient tradition of the farmers going way inland, clearing the debris, and doing their rice planting and taking their whole families with them. Their whole families with them. So everybody would sing as they planted. Everybody sang. Unfortunately, I don't think they do this anymore. But they did it for hundreds of years. They all sang together. And they knew that if they sang together, they sang with joy, they sang with enthusiasm, that it would encourage those little rice sprouts to grow. It does. It encourages them to grow. Even as dumb as the Heart Sutra sounds, if we chant it every morning, something happens. Something happens. Because we give ourselves to it, and it's beautiful. But you can do, if you don't like the Heart Sutra, you can do the Metta Sutta. That's the loving kindness. That's Maitreya's own sutra. You can chant that every morning. But however you want to sing, just sing. Just sing. That's Maitreya. Even if you can't carry a tune. I like it. I have a grandson now. I liked it when my kids were little because they didn't know I couldn't carry. My grandson is not three yet. He doesn't know I can't carry it. So he loves it. Well, in about a year or so, everybody's going to be groaning. Well, that's the way. That's life. But whether you carry a tune or not doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. So, I go every year for 5 or 6 years to a small island in the Caribbean, which is 8 miles long and 4 miles wide. And there's a big story around that, but I won't get into that story. Anyway, I go there with my wife, sometimes my family. And what I like to do when I go there, my very favorite thing, although I like everything there, but my very favorite thing is to go into the innermost country. To go into the inner, every trip I at least want to go into the innermost country once. And this is 8 miles long, 4 miles wide, but it has a 3,000 foot peak there, if you can imagine that. And at about 2,500 feet, if you walk on a trail for a couple of hours, it's a little bit slippery, but if you do it, or maybe two and a half hours, you get to something that's called the source. Sounds Zen-like, huh? But it's really the source of drinking water. That's what it is. You get to something that's called the source. And that source, all the original flora and fauna from pre-Columbian times, because they couldn't cut it down because it's too steep. They couldn't plant sugar cane because it's too steep. They couldn't harvest it. And so, but there's always a song there. Whenever you go into the innermost country, there's a song. But it takes some effort. It takes some effort to discover this innermost country. And you lose faith sometime that it's really here. You think, oh, Tim knows how to do it. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to do anything. It's here. It's here. So this country that I go to, Nevis, it has an interesting story. The reason it's called Nevis is that Columbus discovered it on his second trip. And Columbus, we think, was a fairly bright guy. But in this case, he wasn't so bright. He saw the clouds at the top on the top of the mountain, which are very white. And since it rains all the time there at the top of the mountain, it's almost always in clouds. And he thought it was snow. So he named it Nieve. Nieve. And then what did Columbus do? Well, Columbus came back on another trip. And he subjugated all the native population, all the Indians. He took them off, made them slaves. The rest of them died from white man's disease. So that was the first thing he did. The second thing that happened was that the British found out that Columbus had found this place. So the British, being imperialists then, as we are now, right? We've replaced them. I mean, pretty much we have. You can't deny it, can you? Some people want to argue that, but They can argue all they want. The British, oh, Columbus found this place. The Spanish have this place. We'll check it out. So they checked it out, and what do? They found sugar cane. They thought, oh, sugar cane, sweets, sweets. We can tear down some of this forest and plant sugar cane. Oh, but they started tearing down and planting it, but they had nobody to harvest it. So what did they do? Went to Africa, got slaves, captured human beings like us, put them in boats, fed them one meal a day, took them to this tiny island and made them harvest the sugar cane. So then Nevis was called the Queen of the Caribbean because they harvested so much sugar cane, which they brought back to Britain. Well, the French heard about this and they thought, geez, what are the British doing here? We want to check this out. They went down with their warships. They fought the British. They had a huge battle right off the coast of this 4x8 island. They beat the British. They took over Nevis and St. Kitts for 12 years. They took over the slaves. They took over the sugar cane. Well, the British came back. The British beat them out again. And then the British kept it. The British kept it till what? 1800s? Well, 1800s, something happened. Sugar beets were developed. All of a sudden, the British couldn't make money off it. All of a sudden, it wasn't worth keeping the slaves population. So that they all left. And they left the slaves there. So this is our human history. This is our human history, not just Nevis. This is our human history of greed, of hatred, of stupidity, over and over again. That's why the practice of Zazen, to me, is so important. Deconstructing that stuff. Deconstructing. Which doesn't mean fighting with it. It means seeing that it's all made up stuff. It's all made up stuff. And using Maitreya when we get discouraged. Using Maitreya's hope as our own hope when we get discouraged. As our own vision when we get discouraged. So here's a poem by Lou. Oh, no, I'm not going to do that yet. I'm going to say something about Wendell Berry. So Wendell Berry talks a lot about environmental destruction and how we can take care of it. And he's, when he's at his best, he's a Maitreya kind of guy. When he's at his worst, he's pissing and moaning. But sometimes we're all pissing and moaning, right? But here, as a Maitreya guy, he says, the great work before us, the task of moving modern civilization from its present devastating influence on the earth to a more benign mode of presence, is not a role that we've chosen. We didn't choose this situation. It's a role given to us beyond any consultation with ourselves. We did not choose. We were chosen by some power beyond ourselves for this historical task. We don't choose the moment of our birth, our particular culture, or the historical moment when we will be born. We don't. And for me, given my advanced age, what we're doing to the planet via global warming, via our environmental destruction, it's not going to affect me too much. It's not going to affect me too much, unless I live to be 192 or something. But it is going to, and I don't think it's going to affect much my children who are in their 30s. But I'm concerned about our grandchildren. I'm really concerned about them. We should all be concerned about them and our great-grandchildren. So Lew Welsh is a poet who... also, he's a poet who wrote this in the 60s. He's a 60s guy. He's dead now. But he wrote this with a spirit of hope. And he wrote it about Maitreya. Maitreya poem. At last, in America, Maitreya, the coming Buddha, will be our leader. And at last, we'll not be powerful. And we'll not be alone. Take it as a simple prophecy. Look into the cleared eyes of so many thousands, young, and think, maybe that one, that one, that one. Look out. The secret is looking out. and never forgetting there are phony ones and lost ones and foolish ones. Know this. Maitreya walks our streets right now. Each one is one. There are many of them. Look out for him, for her, for them, for these will break America as Christ cracked Rome. And just tonight, another one got born. Another one got born. So Maitreya also is considered the bodhisattva who is the fool. He is considered the fool. And there are lots of historical figures who are considered to be bodhisattvas because they were so foolish. But Maitreya is a fool for love. He's a fool for love. He rushes in where angels fear to tread. Remember that old song? Completely a fool for love and hope. A fool for it. But he doesn't know. He just does it. He just does it. Because he's got his partner, Manjushri, who has deconstructed all of that stuff that we project into the future. All of that neediness based on not getting what we want, getting what we don't want. It comes from our grasping and clinging and insecurity. So he's a fool for love. And there are lots of characters. I'm not going to talk about them today because I've talked, I think, long enough. But you guys know the characters in Zen. Hanshan in Chinese Zen and Shite in Chinese Zen. Hanshan and Shite, who, when everybody's being proper within the monastery, following all the rules, wearing their robes just so, chanting right, eating bowls right. What are Hanshan and Shite doing? They're outside the monastery, turning somersaults, playing, poking each other, poking the monks as they pass by. They're our Dharma ancestors, Hanshan and Shite. They are our Dharma ancestors. You see pictures of them. In one picture of Hanshan, all you see is shht. It's one brush stroke, and that's like his smile. Because everything else is gone. He's just whirling around. You know, that's all that's left. And then we have Ryokan in the 17th century in Japan. Ryokan, the great fool Ryokan. If you read about his life, you know he was a total fool. A total fool. His father wanted to be someone, but he only cared about two things, doing zazen and playing with kids. That's all he liked to do, zazen and play with kids. He also did some writing and some little bit of artwork. The fool Ryokan, the fool Ryokan. When he was playing with kids, he used to play hide and seek with kids, and one day he was playing hide and seek with kids, and he found a really good hiding place. You know the story? He found a really good hiding place. Such a good hiding place that the kids didn't find him, and they all went home. But Ryokan kept hiding. He didn't know. He was having a great time. A great time. So this is our lives. We have this potential to be the Maitreya who we are, as fools for love, as fools for hope. In a world that doesn't look that cool, but it's great because we are planting rice seeds and they're growing and we're nurturing them. And I actually consider, and I've talked about this before, Martin Luther King, in a way, I can remember my dad saying to me, "Oh, that guy is a fool." Of course, my dad was a conservative Republican. What do you expect? That guy is a fool. He's not going to change any of those people in the South. It's going to be, he said it's going to be decades before black people will be able to ride the bus. It'll be decades before the schools are integrated. Even though my father was conservative Republican, he believed in integration because he was from the West Coast. You know, that's progressive, supposedly progressive. But my grandfather, who was a liberal, also said to me, "Well, Tim, he really is a fool. I think he's going to get himself in trouble. he said, I went through the South once, and the way they treated even me, because I had a northern accent, was scary. I think he is a fool. Oh. And Martin Luther King knew he was a fool. He knew it. He knew the odds were very slim. You read his biography. He knew the odds were very slim that he was going to accomplish his dream. But he put it out. At that time in his life, he was Maitreya. He put it out there. And he also, he had a premonition, right? For months that he was going to be assassinated for doing this. For months. Well, he didn't, not that he was going to be assassinated, but that he wouldn't live, that he would die before he was 40 because of this work. And he kept doing it. He even came out against the Vietnam War when he didn't need to do that. He didn't need to do that. But then he made Lyndon Johnson his enemy. He made the President of the United States, who had really supported him, his enemy. But he was a fool for love. He was a fool. And then, of course, he died. But would we have Barack Obama as Democratic nominee if it weren't for Martin Luther King? Would we? I don't think so. I don't think so. So the last fool that I'm going to talk about is the one that I talk about almost every week. My apologies to whomever, to you guys, I guess, is Suzuki Roshi, my first teacher. My first teacher wanted to come to America when he was 19. He thought, oh, in America, I can maybe teach people how to return to their still nature, because these Japanese are all live in these fortresses they've created, these cultural fortresses of what they think Buddhism is about, what they think Buddhism is, how they think you should behave to be a Buddhist, right? So he didn't get to go when he was 20s. And then the war came and he still didn't get to go. And then his 30s and then his 40s. And then finally in his late 50s when his health's not good, he's told, oh, you can go to San Francisco. Or you can go hang out, be the priest for these Japanese people in San Francisco. And he did it. He did it. He was happy to do it. He came with joy. He came with love. But not, he saw this kind of hippie love in the Haight-Ashbury, and he thought, He never talked about love because the hippies, he felt, oh, I was one too. He felt like we were overusing the term. We didn't really know how to cultivate the little seed in the bare ground. We were just love, 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 love. That kind of sentimental love is head love. That's not the love that comes out of this wonderful stillness that you discover in your sitting, in your walking. Now, maybe you can't do sitting meditation very well. Then walk. And do slow walking. Just slow walking. Maybe around your favorite tree or in your backyard. Maybe just for 5 minutes a day so that you can really see the needles on that tree. You can really see the dew on each needle. You can really see the ant Buddhas crawling on the needles and appreciate their ant nature. Do that. Please do that. Then you'll be bringing Maitreya alive in your life. So Suzuki Roshi came and he lived only for 12 years. And he died of cancer. After 9 years, he got cancer here. And there was no Zen here then. There was no Zen monastery. There was a little Rinzai Zen on the East Coast. There was no Zen like we do it then. Just 9 years before his cancer. As a result of that, we're here today, and there are Soto Zen centers all over the country today. Because he was a fool. He was a fool. So I think that's all I need to say this morning, but I'll be glad to take questions or comments or stories or songs out of tune or in tune. Yeah. Well, there is something called idiot compassion that's not the kind of foolishness that I'm talking about. That idiot compassion is when we try to fix things. We try to fix things. We try to make them different. We try to get people to shape up because somehow we feel so inadequate ourselves that we're going to pull them up ourselves, even though they don't want to be pulled up. That's called idiot compassion. I'm using the term from the Tibetan Buddhists. Yeah, idiot compassion the Tibetan Buddhists talk about. Not very different from what we talk about in 12-step as what? Codependency. Codependency, you know. Because of our own inadequacy, because of our fear, our desire, our grasping, our insecurity, we then want to take care of this other person, but we do it based on our own projections, not out of stillness, not just out of the foolishness of just being, but out of projection. Yeah, good point. Thank you. Other people this morning. Yeah,
I have a sucker. I stumbled across a podcast. I think it was Reb Anderson, but he was playing the Donovan song. First there's a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is, which is now a commercial.
Is that right?
And it's from a Dogen, and he's like, he does a whole talk on Dogen's there's a mountain, there isn't a mountain, there is a mountain.
It's a commercial.
Yeah, it's for a car. A car commercial in America. So we're very zen now.
Oh, boy. How exciting. Any other comments or questions? Yeah, in the back. You have to be loud or come up here. Oh, yeah. Well, the four walls are simply the four things that Nagarjuna negated. He negated, first of all, the belief in I. That's like the central negation that Buddhism is all about. Because we carry around this little Tim in our heads. Big Tim, whatever. Unhappy Tim, you know, whatever. We carry this little Tim that's been created. It's been created by our parents, by our culture. And this little Tim is always talking to himself, always worrying, always comparing. Is he doing a good enough job teaching? Are people falling asleep? Although, actually, I don't mind at all. But little Tim minds. Little Tim don't. Right? So we carry this little person around for our whole lives. And it's a fabrication. It's a fabrication. That's the first wall. If you once you've taken that wall down, you're doing pretty good. That's the front wall. You take that front wall down and you let a lot of air in. It only takes one front wall. One wall gone, you let a lot of air in. Woo! But then the second wall is the wall that there's no Tim. That there's no Tim. Oh, there's no Tim. Wow. I'm everyone. I'm everything. I just hang out in the universe. Suffering off suffering, that's just a fabrication. So no Tim can become very, not childlike, but childish. Childish. Hippy-dippy childish, right? Hippy-dippy childish. Yep. So that's the second wall. The third wall is the wall that says there's neither I nor not I. So, or we should say neither both I and not I. Neither both. So we like to say, oh, now I've got it worked out. There's Tim, but at the same time he's a fiction and there's no Tim. So we have it worked out in our head. And we carry that new concept around with us. Ah, this is my religion. This is a cool religion. Both and, both hot and cold, both I and not I. We carry that new one around in our head. So then that third wall gets deconstructed. And then the fourth wall is there's neither no I nor lack, nor no lack of I. Neither no I nor no lack of I. Okay? Is that very helpful? Nagarjuna drives most people crazy. They do not find him helpful at all. But I can't help but bring him in once in a while. because he's one of our teachers. One of our teachers.
Well, it seems like there might be, like, that sounds like a nice uniform way of taking out a house, but what if you're like, you take one wall down, and then while you're working on this wall, this other one comes back?
That's right. That's right. So you can't, but he's not suggesting you take it down in sequence.
Yeah.
He's suggesting that the whole edifice is, it's a fort that isolates you. That you only need one wall to feel cut off, to feel like you've got to manipulate other people, like you've got to get them to be a certain way. You only need one wall. So it's true, he does it. He's a logician, right? He's a logical guy. He takes the Heart Sutra, which is not, doesn't have much logic in it, and just gives it its own logical framework. You've been chanting the Heart Sutra. You know what I'm talking about. Anything else? Oh, hi.
Hi.
Good to see you.
Nice to be here. Nice to hear you talk.
Okay.
So, I apologize for this question.
Oh, she's apologizing for a question.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's like it would be great to ask a deep Dharma question. But the thing where I hung up was, wait, he thinks he's getting really old. That seems a little odd to me.
What?
He thinks he's not going to be here to reap the benefits, the consequences of global warming. That seems, what do you mean you're not going to be here? It's already there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm just speaking lightly. I mean, in terms of this body, I'm probably not going to experience some incredible increase in temperature. I'm probably not going to experience the Caribbean getting so warm that there are no fish in it or no anymore. That there are no reefs. You know, I love to do snorkeling, but I would say that if we're going the way we're going in 50 years, there won't be any snorkeling to speak of because there won't be any reefs yet left. Maybe 50, 75 years. So in this body, right?
But I figured you meant in this body.
Yeah.
I just thought it's like, what, you know, given all those bridges that are out right now.
All the what?
The bridges that are out.
Yeah.
All the droughts and all the famines.
Yeah. Well, it could happen in this lifetime.
Well, it's happening right now.
Yes, but the thing is, it's as a middle-class person living in the middle of America, it's not affecting me very much.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is an unfortunate attitude. I understand that you're not you have that attitude, but a lot of people think it's not affecting them.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. It is affecting me. It's affecting me profoundly. It's just not making my life very difficult.
Yeah.
I'm not seeing in my physical being what this destruction is wreaking. I'm not experiencing it cellularly. Yeah.
Just a brief comment about Nagarjuna.
About what? Nagarjuna?
I always think that the greatness of Nagarjuna is that he used logic, but he used it to go beyond it. He didn't really use logic for establishing a kind of conceptual.
That's right. That's right. Right. That's right. Yes, and you know out of Nagarjuna there became the emptiness teaching. The teaching that's what really Buddhism is about. And what did Nagarjuna say about emptiness? He said, "The belief in emptiness is the worst fault of all." Yeah. Good. Thank you. No, that's right. That's right. That's right. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah, Manoj.
How am I linking Nagarjuna and global warming? So, yes, it is true that global warming is a big problem, obviously, that, but the opposite side of it is that we can also become arrogant and say that, oh, we are capable of destroying the world and already causing a lot of problems, you know, biofuels and people go the other way and try to, like, fix it.
Yeah.
A lot of people have said that, you know, human beings cannot really destroy the universe.
That's right.
He'll destroy us before we can
Yes. Yes, so even if the human species doesn't do so well, it's not going to mar the life force, the force that comes out of the ground of non-being being. That force, that life, is always there whether human beings make it or not. So we're always safe, really. We're completely safe. On the one hand. On the other hand, it's not very kind. We're not being very kind.
Well, and that's a hard thought to take consolation with, because what we're doing right now is harming that thought, you know, the life force in a lot of ways.
We are, but ultimately that life force can't be harmed, because it's beyond duality. It's just this, whatever it is. It will always be a planet or a solar system or something, right? Peter.
Sorry, just all of which is still in the realm of I exist.
Of what?
That whole conversation that just happened was all in the realm of existence.
That's right.
Just, I had to say that.
Okay, yeah, she's playing the role of Nagarjuna. Good. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
One thing we learned from geology, I studied at college and I also studied by hiking the Grand Canyon in different places, and you find that over the course of time that nature has a way of kind of change.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
You see things like, you know, like a lava pool around the western end of the Grand Canyon, or a lava pool down the canyon.
Right.
And then, you know, over the course of time, this is really hard rock, this lava. Over the course of time, the river just eat through it. So, you know, we've made dams on the Colorado River now, you know, one canyon dam, Hoover Dam.
Uh-huh.
And we think that these are changing the ecology permanently, but they're only temporary. Dams really don't last that long. They kind of soak up and fill up. So they're only a temporary, like, continually for a few years, and problem is that we, while these dams are up, we're kind of temporarily altering our enjoyment of these things. Like Glen Canyon dams.
That's right.
Destroyed.
That's right.
And so these things don't last forever, you know. But
yep. Yeah.
We can't enjoy these.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Larry. I don't think I'll do any more questions, but I will do a little PR thing now. We're going to be in our evening study group. We're going to be studying the Heart Sutra in the month of September. So please come join us, and we can all deconstruct together. So thank you.